Okay. Pretty much bang on time. I would like to say thank you to all the people present here today. I know that the month of May is particularly demanding on many of us, including the master's students and other students who are present here, and all various types of staff who are taken up with exams, invigilations, and so forth. But above all, of course, I would like to thank Christine and Elizabeth for travelling all the way from Britain on this occasion today. I'm very sorry you didn't meet the lovely Provençal sun today, but perhaps it's a blessing in disguise because it's already rather hot in this room. If that's okay with you, we shall proceed as we normally do. That is to say, we shall hear both your papers, one after the other, and then use the remaining time for questions and a debate. So it is my pleasure to welcome here Elizabeth McKellar, who is a senior lecturer.
No, professor, actually.
Sorry. Sorry, yes, of course we changed. Professor. a professor now. Still staff tutor?
No.
No? Okay. In the art and history department, department at the Open University. And Elizabeth has previously held posts at the Victoria and Albert Museum, and also at the Birkbeck College. They're very active in the domain of art. University of London. She's a specialist of 17th and 18th century British architecture and culture, urbanism and architectural historiography, and the author of The Birth of Modern London, The Development and Design of the City, 1660-1720, at Manchester University Press. And also, and I will trust you to pronounce the name of your co-author, Barbara
Artichesca.
Thank you. And the title is Articulating British Classicism, New Approaches in 18th Century Architecture. She currently holds a Leverhulme Research Fellowship, or did when biography was put online, and is researching a book for Yale University Press entitled The Landscapes of London, The London Journal. She's also been an expert assessor for museums, the Museums, Libraries and Archives Council designation scheme for collections of national and international importance. It's a very long title. And a member of the Executive Council of the Association of Art Historians. And also you're currently a member of the English Heritage London Advisory. Correct, yes? So the title of today's presentation will be Landscapes of the Suburban, Rethinking the London Margins, 1660 and 1840. I will introduce Christine just before your talk. That's okay. Thank you.
Right, well, thank you very much, Laurence. In fact, this work is out now. It's a book published by Yale University Press, and you can see the front cover there. And the subtitle, in case you can't read it, which you probably can't, is The City, the Country and the Suburbs, 1660 to 1840. And so what I'm going to talk about today is one, I'm going to try and give you a very short overview of the kind of theme of the book, and then I'm just going to concentrate on one particular aspect to talk about this theme, because I only have half an hour. So the book is about cities and where they begin and end, and what happens in the space between the beginning and the end, and how do you know where that is? Cartography suggests that towns end where the black lines on the map finish, but experience tells us otherwise. As Michel de Certeau has written, maps only refer to the absence of what has passed by. The trace left behind is substituted for the practice. And that's particularly true when there's no trace at all, when the map is blank, but where we know from other evidence that there is life beyond the fringe. And in my work, I drew on a very wide range of sources, and I'm happy to talk about that in the questions. I'm not going to talk about it here. Maps were one, but buildings were another very obvious one, but I also looked at poems and songs and lots of topographical prints and so on. And all of these suggested there was life beyond the fringe. F.M.L. Thompson wrote of London's development pre-1800, "This growth has not so much filled up empty spaces on the map as occupied particular districts which already had existences of their own. And it's tracing the connection between those existences and spaces that's the theme of this book." I've been inspired by the concept of the postmodern global megacity, the post-suburban or edge cities, as they're called, in doing this. And that's become a common term in late 20th, 21st century cities. And it became increasingly apparent to me that London in the long 18th century had its edge city or exopolis also, obviously different in character. And as I said, a wide range of sources provided powerful and compelling evidence that London's outer London's growth in the 18th century was far more vigorous and complex than the normal catch-all term satellite development conveys. Now, in looking at the relationship between the urban and the rural, no one can escape the pull that Raymond Williams's classic work, The Country and the City of 1973, still exerts. And my subtitle, of course, The Country, the City and the Suburbs, is a reference to that. His theme, hugely simplified, was the exploring the distinction between the pastoral idyll versus a corrupting urban environment. And that was enthusiastically embraced by subsequent generations of scholars, leading to a split in cultural studies between urban and rural scholarship. His influence on scholars exploring the cultural construction of what had become, in effect, two separate spheres, to use the gender studies debate, could not be overestimated. But Williams himself, in an essay written just before he died, sought to redress the balance, and he wrote an essay called Between Country and City, arguing that his book was in fact concerned with connections, or we should be looking at connections as much as oppositions. And since then, there have been a number of works which sought to break down that binary and explore connections between the city and the country. Just to single one out, for early 19th century London, Dana Arnold has looked at the urban and the rural as having shared values rooted in land, arising from the practice of land ownership in the West End estates, which are great estates owned by landowners who also own land in the country. My book, by contrast, is focused on the middle class and their practices and culture, and I argue that these were central to a new kind of urban-rural configuration in the environs, which I know is a French word as well, so you know what it means, in the outer areas, a zone which had a far more fragmented pattern of land ownership and no history of large-scale estate development until the second quarter of the 19th century, so after my period. So what I'm looking at really is a new landscape arising not out of aristocratic land ownership, but out of the consumer society of the metropolitan middle classes in the long 18th century, which created something neither city nor country, but something in between that we might characterise as suburban. Okay, now just very briefly, I'm not going to talk about maps in any detail, but just to give you an idea of what I mean by the outer areas of London, and the London region, as I actually term it in the book. This is a map, as you can see, from about 1690, showing London 20 miles around. And the first map of this type was actually as early as 1683. So really from the beginning of the period, people are producing maps which have this concept of a London region. And this map by Philip Lee, the area it encompasses is roughly the position of the current M25, which is the London Périphérique. And it's very interesting that the sort of historical geography has carried down to the present day. And it begins to give us, again, I'm afraid we can't go into detail today, but it gives a really detailed picture of the suburban terrain. It shows parish churches, villages, gentlemen's and ordinary houses, as they're termed, roads and rivers, all marked with their own symbol. Even market towns are distinguished typographically from villages and hamlets. So far from being a blank space, this is a known and mapped terrain. There is an overemphasis on the gentle, the gentry. You can perhaps... the thing is a bit small, but can you just see these little rings? These are Parkland estates. So it overemphasises the gentry because, of course, they were part of the subscribers who funded such maps. But nevertheless, it gives a really detailed coverage, and it also includes a lot of industry and commercial development, particularly along the rivers, where it marks all different kinds of copper mills and industrial activity. It also shows the other major role of the environs in this period, which is as an urban playground and leisure retreat from the dust and congestion of the centre. And that's indicated through the detailing of mineral spas and wells all around the capital. And there's a huge number of these shown on the map. The one thing it doesn't show is the other major activity of the region, which is, of course, farming and agriculture. But that balance between farming, market garden, the traditional activities of this area, and the new activities of leisure, increased types of dwelling, industry, perfectly represents the sort of balance in this in these areas in the period. So on the one hand, we have the sinews of change carving through the landscape in the form of roads, industrial rivers, expanding villages, and new leisure attractions. On the other hand, we have the traditional depiction of a landscape dominated by the gentry and the aristocracy. And this type of map, showing the London and the country around, carried on right the way through the 18th century into the 19th century, and the distance gets bigger and bigger, so it goes to 20 miles, 30 miles, 40 miles, and ends up about 60 miles, which is really taking us quite a long way from, like, even today, that would be stretching it. Another characteristic of the maps I just want to refer to very briefly, which I could do a whole session on, but it's not going to be the theme today, is this idea of circuits around the city. So many of the maps actually measure the distances in concentric rings from St. Paul's in the centre. And then other ones have these kind of psycho-geographical boundaries, like the limits of the penny post that we see here, or the other most obvious one is the turnpike gates all around the city, which created rings and layers through which people used and understand the space outside the centre. So that's just to give you a very, very brief idea about both the scope, the themes, and the actual sort of physical geography that I'm talking about. What I want to focus on now for the rest of this talk is these leisure resorts and spas around the city. And I think that because they perhaps show best the relationship between these outer areas and the West End, and how urban identities were created as much in the outer areas as in the West End and the centre. So I'll look at the alternative environment, both landscaped and built, of the London fringe, which was rooted in the particularities of local history and topography, but which at the same time was dependent upon and intimately related to the urban milieu. I will suggest that we need to redefine and extend our concept of the urban in this period to incorporate the periphery as well as the centre, the impolite and the polite, the old alongside the new. And then just to start perversely with a view of the centre, however, we can see that city and country were closely connected at a number of levels throughout the long 18th century. Londoners lived in close proximity to the surrounding countryside, as we can see here at Soho Square, and had long used the hinterland as part of their normal locale, as a place for outdoor sporting activities, military exercises, and for repose and relaxation. And the places I'm going to be focusing on particularly is Islington, which is just about here. There's another hill just off the map, which again was often shown in topographical views. So that's the area we're going to be looking at. The landscape features of the capital were held to consist of the river environment of the Thames, most notably at Greenwich, shown here, and Richmond, the flat meadowlands to the south, and what later became known as the Northern Heights of Highgate, Hampstead and Islington, which we saw in the previous slide, which featured prominently as a natural boundary and views to the north. The purpose of the hinterland as an urban playground was greatly enhanced from the late 17th century onwards by the development of a range of commercial entertainments catering for all sectors of society, in which pleasure grounds, spas, inns and tea and assembly rooms all vied for the custom of pleasure-seeking city dwellers. And the ones I'm talking about today, you can see in this map how many there are. So the central area is here, and we're looking at this cluster around here. So just to the north of the city, and the city, by the city I mean the City of London, the commercial heartland, so the business district, and that's important that it's above the business district, not the court. Okay. Guidebooks and travellers' accounts of the same period began to include the semi-rural zone as a new type of literature emerged, beginning with Edward Hatton's A New View of London of 1708, which sought to convey the contemporary experience and distinctiveness of urban life. Daniel Defoe, in his tour of Great Britain of the 1720s, devoted a whole section to the villages surrounding London, which he related were heavily used as dormitories by wealthy city merchants, as well as providing playgrounds for day trippers. The view of the region presented in commercial guides of the period was necessarily heavily slanted to cater for the tourist itinerary. The much reprinted Foreigner's Guide of 1729, which was produced in English and French in a facing page format, so these two set side by side all the way through the book, has the outline parts of one of the four sections of the book. And this is this market in tourist guides is a pan-European phenomenon. So there are guides to Paris selling in London, there are guides to London selling in Paris, there are translations into Dutch, to French, to English, and so on. So it's a very interesting network of these kind, not just prints, but also these printed accounts. And I have written an article actually about the Paris-London relationship, which again I'm happy to answer questions on. And like the maps, these guides continue through the 18th century, and as with the maps, the sort of range goes further and further, and the amount of detail devoted to the environs gets greater and greater. For example, in the Ambulator, which is a well-known walking guide, Ambulator, in the late 18th century, the environs are called an Elysium, in which the man of leisure may find amusement and the man of business the most agreeable relaxation, notably at the many mineral spas which surrounded the capital. And Defoe, who had a very acute eye for social topography, said that The nobility and gentry go to Tunbridge, the merchants and rich citizens to Epsom. So the common people go chiefly to Dulwich and Streatham, the rather also because it lies so near London that they can walk to it in the morning and return at night. And it's one of those places that you could walk to and return at night, Islington, that we're going to focus on now. Islington's open aspect and the course of the artificially cut New River through its fields had long made it frequented as a place for taking the air and engaging in outdoor activities. Wenceslas Hollar, the Bohemian, and one of the first artists to depict London's landscapes, portrayed it as a place of retreat and contemplation in his Views of London of 1665. Islington was also known as the Dairy of London, because it was full of dairy herds producing milk for the city, and had an important function as one of the main routes connecting Smithfield, which was the main London meat market, with the north and east, providing an overnight stopping point for those taking sheep and cattle to slaughter. And so you see here sheep being driven down Islington High Street past the church. The area was transformed at the end of the 17th century with the discovery in 1683 by Mr. Sadler of a medicinal spring in the gardens of his music house, which opened as a spa. This was followed in quick succession by the establishment of several rivals, including the New Tunbridge Wells, Islington Spa, the London Spa, and so on. The Islington pleasure houses' fortunes waxed and waned through the long 18th century, reaching their peak of fashionability in the 1730s. But throughout, they maintained a reputation for an exceptionally socially mixed clientele. And you can see in this slide here, St. Paul's in the background there, the city churches. So you can see it is a couple of fields away, as it was described, from the city. And as was previously mentioned, the course of the New River, which finished up here, created this sort of artificial riverine, pleasant landscape around the city. In response to this social diversity, a dual mode of depicting the Islington resorts developed, which veered between the wholesome and the licentious. The Hollar tradition continued with representations, as we see here, of the area as a healthy open space for family outings and sporting activities, particularly fishing and shooting. Scenes showing the urban middle classes in their semi-rural playground, the poor man's equivalent of the country estate, were common and frequently satirical in nature. And this is an example of one of these satirical prints by Hogarth, Evening of 1738, in which he shows a city couple out strolling along the New River, which you can see in the front there, past the Sadler's Wells Inn, and the man has horns on his head, representing him as a cuckold. So although he's out on this family jaunt, other things are obviously going on as well. And this series, The Four Times of Day, covers all four, was actually commissioned for the rival attraction of Vauxhall Gardens, of course, about which a huge amount has been written, by Jonathan Tyers, in an attempt to differentiate his more refined grounds from these more plebeian ones to the north. So part of what I'm trying to do here is get away from the emphasis on Vauxhall. I don't know if you know the latest thing, the massive, massive Yale book on Vauxhall, to show that there are a lot of other resorts around at this time as well. The spas around London promoted themselves for their health-giving purifications, fresh air and open countryside, but they were also known as venues for drinking and gambling and gained a more ambiguous reputation as places of sexual immorality. from F. Calzone's Le Guide de Londres of 1693, another French guidebook, and Ned Ward's The London Spy of 1709 onwards, the less respectable inns and pleasure grounds, particularly those of Islington, became a staple of sex tourism guides and low-life accounts of the city. This alternative tradition informs the Bickham view, entitled The Charms of Déshabillé, or New Tunbridge Wells, 1733. Déshabillé here meaning undress or informal dress, morning dress, as opposed to formal dress, not complete déshabillé, produced at the height of its success when it was patronised by the princesses Amelia and Caroline. The risque ditty by Lockman below celebrates the potential risks and misalliances of mixed company in both senses of the word. And just to read you a tiny extract. Whence comes it that ye shining great, to titles born and awful state, thus condescend, thus check their wills, and scud away to Tunbridge Wells, to mix with vulgar beaux and belles? The depiction of the healthy pleasure of the takings of the water, which is around the waters around the central spa there, and the enjoyment of the attractive grounds, are juxtaposed in the plate with the more equivocal message of the song, and the image of the image itself, in which the languorous poses of those shown position round the stairs, speak particularly this woman here, perhaps. Speak of the possibilities of unorthodox encounters in an intermediate space, a space neither town nor country, neither wholly occupied by the polite nor the impolite, an ambiguous arena in which it is possible that the normal moral and social codes of conduct might be suspended. This indeterminacy was also the hallmark of the area's architecture. Islington's metamorphosis into an urban pleasure ground was not matched by any equivalent physical transformation. As topographical views show, activities took place in the fields which had ringed the capitals for centuries, among them dotted cottages, inns and other structures, largely vernacular in feel and only semi-classical at most. The various spas were largely housed in existing buildings, which could generally be characterised as rustic until at least the latter half of the century, as we can see here with Sadler's Wells, another Bickham print, which contrasts tellingly with the previous one. So whereas the previous one showed an image of sophisticated worldly pleasures, in this one the pretense of rural innocence is maintained. And the song here, instead of talking about déshabillé and checking one's will, talks about pleasant streams, gentle murmurs, the water gliding along in which the sporting fishes play to close each wearied summer's day, the sweetest gales, and finishes by saying, which give new health and heat repel, such are the joys of Sadler's Wells. And this atmosphere of pastoral sylvan refinement doesn't take place in the classical environment you might expect, but in a pre-Georgian semi-vernacular building. And in the view, the foreground, the pond, the walled garden, the river, the swans take precedence. This picture of the building is thought to be largely accurate. You can see that it's had a wing added on to the left, and again, later research has shown that that was actually the case. So what happened is that these spas took over existing buildings, extended them, adapted them, and so on. And this block at the end is actually visible in the end of that Hogarth print of Evening. Now, if we compare this 1728 view with a later view published in 1814, but actually showing the building, it's a reproduction of, from the 1790s, we can see the change that has come over the building. It was rebuilt by a new proprietor who erected a new theatre, which you can see with the weather vane here, so that runs that way, and a new house for himself and his family here. So although this building is certainly more classical, it still retains a rustic feel with the steeply pitched roof, the weather vane, and the dormer windows above the house. The illusion of absolute isolation was no longer sustainable, though, and new terraces and buildings are visible in the background here. The surroundings were also updated with the addition of lamps and railings along the river and the ground. By this date, urban nuisances were beginning to intrude, and in circa 1775, a wall and iron railing was placed along the Wells Walk on the other side to prevent passers-by throwing in their dogs, etc. However, overall, Islington, despite its proximity to the capital, maintained a rural aspect and vernacular buildings until well after the end of the 18th century. This slide shows a detail of the building of the new chapel from a panorama of 1789, and allows us a glimpse of the irregular groupings, gables and pitch roofs of a variety of structures. As late as 1811, John Nelson could write, "The irregular disposition of the houses, intersected and enlivened by the variegated foliage of different sorts of trees, gives the scene a very agreeable and picturesque appearance." In the village, the predominance of traditional architecture was probably more a matter of lack of need and opportunity than anything more conscious, survivalism rather than revivalism, to employ Howard Colvin's useful distinction. But with the vastly expanded number and range of entertainment venues which dotted the fields, this was survivalism of a different order. And we can see the full panorama there. And you begin to see the new terraces that began to be built from the sort of 1780s onwards. But the main development in this area is from the sort of 1810s, 20s. Given the competition to provide novelty and even excess among these different spas, the image projected by the buildings of Sadler's Wells of stability and permanence may seem puzzling. It seems likely that the failure to transform the attendant architecture into the polite classicism of the town was not a matter of oversight or neglect, but a deliberate ploy to help provide a country feel. The spas adjacent to London marketed themselves as a more convenient alternative to those further afield, particularly Epsom and Tunbridge Wells, which, as you remember, Defoe wrote, you had to travel to get to. To emphasise the purity of their product, the spa owners sought to perpetuate a rustic environment redolent of healthiness and tranquility, even paradoxically as this was being undermined by the large number of townspeople who flocked to them. New forms of social interaction and entertainment were being housed here, but this does not mean that new forms of architecture were deployed to do so. And just to sort of finish by saying, this interaction of the cosmopolitan and the rustic visible in the London hinterland requires us to reformulate our characterisation of city and country as two necessarily opposed and discrete entities. This very brief exploration has provided a picture of far more complex and heterogeneous landscapes, in which cosy Middlesex villages and farms intermix with industrial enterprises, shanty settlements and out-of-town leisure developments, in which newly built fashionable terraces sat cheek by jowl with haymaking, albeit of a rather picturesque variety here, and huts and hovels. The image of the city presented here, far from weakening the case for London as the new Rome, as it was often described in the period, in fact strengthens its claim to be the prototype of the fractured modern conurbation, a city of extremities, socially, economically and physically, in which the peripheral, far from being marginal, was central to core aspects of metropolitan identity and experience. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Just about managed to be.
Without even checking your watch, that's absolutely perfect. Thank you so much. It was very evocative, very very vivid picture of London at the time. And the evocation of the Baths particularly is very interesting for us at Aix-en-Provence, obviously, as a city which has very strong links and affiliations with, you know, going to take the waters in Aix, the Quartier Sextus being one of those particular places. But it's a tiny place. It's also a very small town, not, of course, on the scale of London. And I think the strategies would have been very different at the time.
Yeah.
I'm not certain there would have been a merging of classes, cheap by jowl, in the same way in the Baths of Aix-en-Provence. So thank you very much. I will just give you the time you need in order to get all the electronics sorted out. And take.
Yes. Either the PP or PPT. Yes.
Are you happy sitting there?
Yes, but I'll need to. Yes, probably.
Shall we swap these? Yeah, I think.
Thank you.
Just making sure we don't fall over.
Thank you very much.
Oops.
Are you happy with the lighting, Christine?
Yes, that's absolutely fine. Thank you.
If it does get too dark for you to read,
I'm sure
it
will be fine.
I'll put the light on. Okay, it is now a pleasure to welcome Christine Stevenson after Elizabeth McKellar. Christine is a Canadian national. But she's worked in London for many years, first as an editor and then at the University of Reading as a lecturer, and then at the, is it Courtauld,
yeah.
Institute of Art, which is part of the University of London, and I think you've been there since 2002.
Yeah.
After first studying Danish residential institutions, prisons and asylums, Christine's interest steered towards a longer project or perhaps a publication, which was entitled Medicine and Magnificence, British Hospital and Asylum Architecture, 1660-1815. And this was published by Yale University Press in 2000. And that, in turn, created its own sort of virtuous cycle towards the City and the King, with which we started this cycle at the beginning of the year in October. The City and the King, Architecture and Politics in Restoration London, which was published by Yale again in 2014. And was, I have to mention, shortlisted for four different awards. Christine now has two book projects, one about, I find that a fascinating topic, the single room, that is to say a room intended for individual use in prison cells, dressing rooms, cabinets, or even beach huts, both as an artistic and an architectural phenomenon in Britain. And the second project focuses on models, such as maps, architectural models, or these medals, and how they turn neutral or, as you put it, invisible spaces into places which are laden with human experience and aspirations. Christine mentions here, and I think it's a lovely phrase, that she's driven by the conviction that to understand a society, how a society builds, and then how it mediates its architecture and builds spaces, is to go a long way to understanding that society. And this is what we're trying to do in this particular seminar this year, trying to understand how societies think, function, represent themselves through their architecture. Today's talk is entitled Making Empire Tangible at the Second Royal Exchange in London. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your hospitality. I have to say that the title of the talk has to some extent become superseded, as is the way of these things, as I'll explain. After standing for almost exactly a century, the first Royal Exchange in London burned down in the Great Fire. Oops, I'm just trying to find it there. And it was destroyed in London's Great Fire of 1666, and I'm showing it beside its successor, which was finished by 1671, with its great entrance like a triumphal arch facing the street called Cornhill. This building itself burned down in the early 19th century. The third exchange, again on the same site, has not yet burned down. Together, these two buildings have attracted more scholarship than any other place in early modern London, and this is simply because of their prominence in 17th and 18th century performance art and letters. So historians attracted by the Exchange's prominence in Jacobean drama, for example, or Stuart civic ceremony, have shown how it provided a site for negotiating the presence of the alien, the stranger, the foreigner, and the monarch himself or himself in a city that was in important ways a distinct jurisdiction. And when I talk about city today, I mean the city of London proper, which had its own legal privileges, as opposed to the larger metropolis, which was Elizabeth's subjects. Precocious print representations, and these two are good examples, made a century apart, and very rich sculptural programs constituted different kinds of attention paid to the first and second exchanges in their day. And another was the praise and the satire, which turned the building, both buildings, into the engine of global commerce and a miniaturized representation of trade, a model, as it were, with moving parts. For Joseph Addison, who I've quoted on the slide, it was a kind of emporium for the whole earth, the mechanism that united everybody on the globe by their common interest. Around the same time, the anonymous book called Hickledy Pickledy called it the whole world's map, which you may here discern in its perfectest motion, jostling and turning. So my interest has recently been in a small part of the second exchange, which is this statue of Charles II, which was carved by Grinling Gibbons and erected in the center of the courtyard in 1684. You can see it here and here in the drawing overall. But it has to be said that it's pretty inconspicuous, especially by comparison with the dogs. And that's typical. As a monument, this statue was a failure, ultimately. But when it was first erected in this place and in that position, it enacted a particular kind of empire, conceptions of which were debated at that time in the 1680s and still developing. In retrospect, we can look back and see them resolving into the ideology, which was established by the 1730s, of what's called the First British Empire, which is an oceanic empire. It's of trade and settlement. It's one defended by ships and not by troops, and it's unencumbered by the guilt and danger of territorial conquest. That's the First British Empire. It changed after the American Revolution. And for all his very antique costume, Charles II in this statue had a very active part to play in this very self-consciously modern definition of empire, at least for a while. And that's what I'll talk about today, but very briefly. As I said, my title's a little misleading because I want to extend the thesis by considering the statue in relation to yet another of the exchange's roles in early modern London. And that is one of the city's key sites for the expression of political authority as part of the processional routes and as the place of proclamations and punishments. The sheer weight and frequency of these performances turned the exchange into a place of enormous symbolic and actual power. But this power could work both ways, and in the last years of the reign of Charles II, in the first half of the 1680s, the exchange became, in the eyes of the king and his privy councillors, a disordered and suspect and secretive place too, which is odd, considering the building's literal physical openness and its metaphorical operations as a model or map of empire and as the stage for shows of power. So it's that paradox, really, I want to talk about today. So two more innovative prints, Wenceslas Hollar's view of the courtyard of the first exchange, and the second exchange would maintain pretty much this layout, that is, shops on two stories surrounding a rectangular courtyard which is about 33.5 meters from column to column on the longest axis, which is the east-west axis. And at fixed hours, called exchange time, merchants gathered in this space, which was enclosed but roofless, in the open galleries behind the arcading which lined the courtyard. And they met in recognized but physically invisible places called walks, which were defined by their commercial spheres of interest. So you had Canary Walk, Barbados Walk, Virginia Walk, Salter's Walk, Irish Walk. And Hatton's New View of London, a book which Elizabeth mentioned, actually provided the first plan diagram of the walks, and it, as far as I can tell, the first plan diagram of its type in English architecture. The perception that here somehow the commercial world is tangible or graspable was encouraged not just by the naming of the walks and the presence of the foreign traders. You can see that Hollar has very carefully shown the fur hats of the Russian merchants, and you also get turbans in other parts, but by the sheer volume of print information sold and shared at this place. And you can see the woman selling news sheets, and I'm showing another Hollar print, this time of the map of the city and port of Tripoli, now in Libya, which was then of great strategic importance as a place where Barbary pirates, haunted by Barbary pirates. So the sheer volume of print information sold and shared at this place was enormous. It channeled this print into and out of London, as well as throughout the networks of the city itself. And this was what Daniel Defoe would call a strange and universal intelligence, so exquisite, so swift, and so exact, that a merchant sitting at home in his counting house at once converses with all parts of the known world. What's anchoring this universe of print, however, were personal conversations and personal reputations. The exchange itself was personified and spoken about as a collective. It becomes semantically the mouthpiece of the merchant. So again and again, we read in the letters and reports that go to the King's Privy Council, the exchange says that. The whole exchange was not a little joyed at. There was a report yesterday upon the exchange. And sometimes this is qualified. One of the Secretaries of State receives news in 1676 that two men had reported, and these men are described as of good fashion on the exchange, that is, a good reputation on the exchange. And the maintenance of reputation or credit was absolutely essential at this place. In 1632, the humorist Donald Lupton wrote of the exchange merchants that if they visit not once a day, 'tis suspected they are cracking or broken. Though it be almost in the middle of the city, Lupton added, yet it stands by the sea. The exchange is figured as a kind of island within the island. It's permeable to wealth and to knowledge, this intelligence that is universal and immediate. It is said on exchange, and this is from a manuscript newsletter from March 1666, said on exchange that Sir Christopher Minns has taken 14 out of 18 Dutch ships that he met with. This was one during one of the Dutch wars, but the court knows nothing of it. So you get the news there. And this trope whereby the exchange becomes a map or microcosm was reinvigorated by the fire and subsequent rebuilding. Babel of tongues, wrote poet Simon Ford, the universe's fair, where both poles daily met, and what between the vast extent of both the poles is seen, the kingdom's marble chronicle. And the last line refers to the rows of statues of English monarchs in the courtyard's upper stories, which were arranged chronologically, beginning with Edward the Confessor. There were 28 of these by the time of the fire, the most recent being that of the recently restored Charles II, now in his rightful place in the line. Though the statues weren't erected in his lifetime, the original founder of the exchange, Thomas Gresham, had stipulated their inclusion, probably prompted by his direct experience of iconoclasm, both in London and in the Netherlands during the 16th century Reformation. But his immediate inspiration would have been the royal statues in Westminster Hall, which are still extant, a dynastic series commissioned by Richard II in the 1380s. At the exchange, the statues always operated as an index of one of early modern England's central political relationships, that between the City of London and its monarch, and not least when the Council of State ordered the statue of Charles I to be beheaded, a year after the real king was beheaded. The myth of the interdependency of London and the crown, the mutual love and advantage that the partners offered one another, remained potent after Charles II's restoration in 1660, and it always presented difficulties to the chroniclers of London's real relationship with the crown, which was often tense and often antagonistic. Like Westminster Hall, finally, the exchange was a signally public place, one thronged by a miscellany of people going about their business, trading information, and listening to proclamations. War was declared here, peace was announced here, and monarchs' ceremonial entries into London acknowledged the exchange as the physical manifestation of the commercial power which drove the empire. All in all, in other words, what happened at the exchange mattered, even if it didn't matter. The most inconsequential transactions were potentially signs of something. But achieving control over the space behind that great front was sometimes difficult. The exchange was managed by Gresham's trustees, who included some of the most powerful people in London, and they were careful, but troubled, sometimes erupted. And what I've noticed is, from the reports to the Privy Council, is that a place which, in the early reign of Charles I, who came to the throne in 1625, a place which saw more or less random beatings and sword fights, usually called tumults in the record, this place became more suspect as Charles I's relationship with the city deteriorated. And during the reign of his son, Charles II, it became clear that the wrong kind of intelligence could be circulated here, that the exchange's very reputation for authority or truth could be extremely worrying to the king and his ministers. Parenthetically, this must have been an absolutely amazing building, particularly when you consider that St. Paul's, which is seen in the distance in this view, wouldn't be finished for another 35 years when the exchange opened. This, when it was built, this was really a sign of London rising again. I'll skip that slide, I think. Sometimes the threat of disorder at the exchange was a necessary evil. When the exchange was first built in the 1560s, it inherited a centuries-old site of punishment, the pillory, which stood in front of it on Cornhill, which wasn't shown in the prints I've shown. And most of those pilloried there were forgers and other offenders against commerce. And this was a severe punishment where reputation was so important. But I'll offer a couple of more atypical examples. This print shows the juridical torture of James Naylor. This was during the interregnum, which is why the text calls it the Old Exchange instead of the Royal Exchange. Naylor was a particularly eloquent Quaker preacher whose crime was, in October 1656, to have entered Bristol on a horse while his companions cast garments before him while singing, "Holy, holy, holy, Lord God of Sabbath." Naylor's intention seems to have been to testify to the presence of Christ in all of us. He doesn't genuinely seem to have believed that he was the Messiah. But he was tried by Parliament, no less, which resolved that he be whipped through the streets by the hangman, exposed in the pillory at the exchange, have his tongue bored through with red-hot iron, and have the letter B for blasphemy branded on his forehead. His companions were permitted to join him at the pillory, and three women took up poses that observers saw as alluding to the women at the cross. And so, in the opinion of his supporters, Naylor's prophetic sign has now produced its logical conclusion, a symbolic crucifixion. Thinking of the women, though it's today difficult to reconstruct how such concessions worked, they weren't so unusual. A newsletter reported in 1682 that bottles of canary wine were delivered to three men at another pillory, who promptly drank toasts to one of Charles II's most dangerous political enemies, the Earl of Shaftesbury. Negotiations took place between a crowd of onlookers and attending officers. A crowd hostile to a prisoner could be checked by a show of force or not. A big and sympathetic crowd could ensure that canary wine was delivered and the toasts were raised. The exchange pillory operated as part of an exquisitely judged spatial system. Stuart Minson has shown the expansion in both territorial and legal terms of the penitential processions in Tudor London. Like the guilty parties themselves, the prescribed routes navigated the urban spaces in which different forms of legal authority advertised and asserted their jurisdictions, often at the same time. Naylor was whipped through the city, and more than 30 years later, the Court of King's Bench sentenced Titus Oates to stand in the pillory on Monday at Westminster Hall Gate, on Tuesday at the Royal Exchange, on Wednesday to be whipped from Aldgate to Newgate by the common hangman, on Friday from Newgate to Tyburn, and to stand in the pillory also every 24th of April at Tyburn, every 9th of August at Westminster, 10th of August at Charing Cross, 11th of August at Temple Bar, and every 2nd of September at the Royal Exchange. The punishment for Oates' crimes demanded particularly elaborate spatial and temporal structures. In fact, he's inaugurated the most serious political crisis of Charles II's reign with his sensational revelations of the Popish plot, so-called 7 years earlier. And the aim of the plot, according to Oates, and briefly put, was to set fire to London again, assassinate Charles II, replace him on the throne with his Catholic brother James, who would rule under the direction of the Society of Jesus. And that's the sort of simple version. I'll conclude today with more trouble at the exchange, but first wanted to return to the statues for a few minutes. After the fire, the restoration of the line of monarchs at the new building was a very slow affair. Sherwin's print shows the niches still empty and waiting. And as the sculptor John Nost's model of the later Queen Mary shows, these statues would be coloured and gilded as the pre-fire statues had been in the then old-fashioned way. And Charles I went up in its niche in 1683, but it was only after the publication of a mayoral precept in November 1684, which urged the livery companies each to come up with a statue, and then the king's death fewer than 3 months later, that the line of monarchs began to take shape. And it was therefore before the replacement of these statues in the upper tier got underway that the exchange experienced a significantly new kind of intervention with which I began, in the form of the Charles II in the middle of the courtyard, which hadn't been occupied at the old exchange. It was a gift which the Gresham trustees had accepted from the Society of Merchant Adventurers, a cloth trading company based in Hamburg, which paid £500 for the statue and the pedestal. It weathered very badly and was finally replaced entirely at the end of the next century, but Gibbon's bronze of Charles II at the Royal Hospital, Chelsea, which was made very soon after the exchange statue, gives the idea. And this was something entirely new for England. It was very striking that Charles was shown in what one writer called the ancient Roman habit of their Caesars. It's very different from the coloured modern costumes worn by the monarchs looking down in the courtyard. Facing south towards Cornhill, the king stood on a 2.5-metre pedestal, itself elaborately carved with what Hatton described as the imperial crown, wings, trumpets of fame, sceptre and sword, palm branches, and the inscription which lays claim to Charles's imperial possessions, which at that time still included France, or the imperial claims included France. And according to a poem celebrating the statue, the world's united treasure meet to enrich their bank, that is the merchant adventurer's bank, with each returning fleet who lay their hearts and wealth at Caesar's feet. And this sums up one perfectly plausible reading of the statue. Satisfactory gift-giving requires that the recipient, if a superior, condescends to receive the present. And that's the exchange, the condescension in return for the hearts and wealth laid at one's feet. And that kind of exchange was conceivable only within the place created by Charles II's fully three-dimensional presence among the monarchs on the ground, as opposed to that made by his and his ancestors' surveillance from above. Regarding the Caesar in the courtyard, contemporaries could have entered into that imagined place of love and tribute, the place that at fixed hours admits and concentrates and then dispels and disseminates the wash and tide of commerce. And yet, despite the drama, and in many quarters the joy of his restoration, Charles II was never free of anxiety about domestic insurrection. By 1680, his worries had come to include parliaments determined to exclude Catholics like his brother James, the heir presumptive, from the line of succession, so readily identified on the one hand with rows of statues and on the other hand with history itself. And the City of London supported these parliaments, and opposition politicians began to rest their hopes with London, the only united force able to withstand arbitrary government, as one pamphleteer wrote. The publisher of that pamphlet was Benjamin Harris, a a journalist and ultra-Protestant, whose Protestant tutor of 1679, intended for children, includes such instructive illustrations as this one, showing the inevitable results of a return to a Catholic monarchy. The pamphlet which he published, written by another person, Charles Blount, openly supports the claims of Charles II's bastard son, the Protestant Duke of Monmouth, to the throne. And it was on this count of publishing the pamphlet that Harris was arrested and sentenced to imprisonment, a huge fine, and the pillory at the Exchange. And Harris stood in February 1680, when it was reported, nobody threw anything at him, nor indeed spoke a word against him. So forceful were his wife and friends. Meanwhile, the same newsletter tells us, His Majesty, on his return on Saturday from Windsor, resolved to go immediately after Easter thither again to stay there all the summer, and in the meantime to go to Newmarket. Charles II was by this date avoiding London as too dangerous as he would until his death. And it's tempting to regard the Exchange statue, erected the year before he died, as a kind of proxy, superintending not just his commercial empire, but rather more pressingly, the efforts of loyal Londoners, the armed militia troops, to suppress the insurrection that still threatened at the prospect of a Catholic king. But it's with the other image that I wish to conclude, really just because of an anachronistic pun it suggested to me. It was reported to one of the Secretaries of State in May 1680 that, quote, great quantities of the libel entitled A Letter to a Person of Honour Concerning the Black Box have been today scattered and taken up on the Royal Exchange. And I hear there is an intention speedily to disperse them throughout the kingdom, knowing of how pernicious a consequence it must be, etc., etc. And it's interesting that the Exchange is in this way figured as a sort of seed crystal of insurrection. The story of the Black Box came to the Privy Council's attention only 3 weeks before that. And it was a kind of myth that in a black box given to a certain bishop, that a certain bishop had given away on his deathbed 10 years earlier was the proof that the Duke of Monmouth was really Charles's legitimate child. It was the proof of the marriage lines between Charles and the Duke's mother. It was very elaborate in its reportage to the Privy Council. Somebody had talked to somebody who had talked to somebody else about the black box. The story indeed had pernicious consequences insofar as Monmouth would stage a rebellion after his father's death, and that had a particularly bloody aftermath. Now, in science, computing, and engineering, Wikipedia tells me, a black box is a device or a system which can be viewed in terms of its inputs and outputs without any knowledge of its internal workings. To that extent, it could be yet another metaphor for the Royal Exchange in the final years of Charles II's reign. The Exchange's inputs and outputs were the core of a global system, and writers figured the building as both perfectly permeable and as the font of knowledge, intelligence, or truth. At the same time, the Exchange's enormous authority as a collective and as a ceremonial site meant that what happened there mattered, even if it didn't, and not least in the eyes of the king and his counselors, in spite of their own intelligence networks, finding out exactly what was happening there sometimes confronted them with a black box. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Christine, for this fascinating insight into the Royal Exchange and the very lively evocation of how intricately a building can be linked to the political life of an entire court and country, because it influences it and also because it reflects it with its own architecture and the statues, the example of the statues you gave. It's very eloquent in that manner. So thank you both once again for those two very complimentary papers.